Well, the boys turned a barren lot in a rundown neighborhood of a Rust Belt city into a Garden of Eden. Wives, children, a business, and a book. Their digging in the dirt leads us to ask, what else might one grow in a garden?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned in to the 914th edition of the Food Chain Radio program right here on News Talk Radio. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there in Frankfurt who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with engineer Rick O'Shea on the boards. Hello, Rick.
Good day, Michael.
Folks like many other young men, Eric Tonesmeyer and Jonathan Bates, wondered what to do with their lives. Should they move out to the coast, join the Peace Corps, go back to school? Not finding promise in those directions, the boys decided to chuck them all and turn to a barren lot that they had found in a run-down neighborhood in a Rust Belt city into a garden. And not just any garden, mind you, but a permaculture paradise garden with hundreds of edible plants. Girls, the boys figured, would find them there. And so the boys took to that soulless duplex with a tenth of an acre barren lot in the Rust Belt city of Holyoke, Massachusetts, and went to work. In short order, they turned that barren lot into a beautiful garden with hundreds of edible plants and a small seed company. And that is where the girls did find them, and children did follow, as did a book and that seed company. These boys, their family, the garden, seed company, the book, all of it lead us to ask, what else might one grow in a garden? And here to help us play with that, dig around for an answer for that question, we have Eric Tonesmeyer, who is the author of Paradise Lot, The Making of an Edible Garden Oasis in the City. Eric, welcome to the Food Chain.
Thanks for having me. It's very nice to be here.
Hey, you know, when I picked up your book, I thought, gosh, this sounds like a modern times big boy version of Francis Burnett's Secret Garden.
Huh.
Have you ever read The Secret Garden?
I have. It's been some time, but yeah.
Well, did you ever think of that?
You know, I not consciously, but I have a feeling that may have influenced some of what we did, in particular the creating of some sort of private rooms, private outdoor rooms in the backyard.
Well, and that's what you did. But so tell us a little bit about the boys, yourself and Jonathan. You're not just people who idly wandered into gardening. You were pretty much focused on heading in that direction, weren't you?
We were. My interest has really been in permaculture systems ever since about 1990 or so. And Jonathan was very interested in these things as well. He had actually come to it through aquaculture, so he knew more about the aquatic systems. But the principles are mostly the same, you know, and so we had met in Vermont at a course I was teaching and hit it off, and he came down to help me run the seed company in 2000, and we started growing out in the country for a couple of years until we realized it was a bad place to meet women.
Wonder Bread Farm?
Yes, it was on White Loaf Ridge, so we called it Wonder Bread Farm, and it was very nice to be out there. But the other thing is, when you're renting land, it's very discouraging to plant fruit trees on rented land for the fourth or fifth time, and kind of makes you want to find a place to settle down.
Well, and speaking of settling down, let's talk a little bit about permaculture for those people who do not know what the whole notion of permaculture means. I once had the privilege a long time ago here on the Food Chain Radio Show to host a guy named Bill Mollison, who was quite a character.
Indeed, he is.
And
yeah.
And he was the one that kind of came up with the whole notion. But what exactly are you talking about when you say permaculture?
Sure. The one sentence version, I think, is that permaculture is meeting human needs while improving the health of the ecosystems around us. And that's very broad. If you were to boil down what's unique about permaculture as opposed to lots of other excellent sustainable practices out there in the world, I think it's that we are trying to focus on creating functional interconnections between the pieces. So in a garden, that might be, you know, we have vegetable beds here and we have weeds in them every now and then, and those weeds get fed to the chickens. The chickens eat them, and they make beautiful eggs for us, of course, and they make manure, and when that mixes with their bedding by the end of the season, we pull out really nice compost, and that can go right back on the vegetable beds again. So it's about creating those links between the different components in the garden or in the neighborhood or whatever scale farm you might be working at, to try and create an ecosystem that becomes more than the sum of its parts. So that's really all we have that's unique or distinct compared to anybody else.
And the notion is that you could actually take a piece of property and turn it into a permanent garden.
Absolutely. We have a strong emphasis in permaculture on perennial plants, perennial useful plants. And here in our garden, we have about 200 species of perennial plants, or some, including some self-seeding things, I guess. And it's wonderful to go out right now. It's, you know, the snow has just melted about a week ago for us, and I have four or five species of vegetables already up 3 or 4 inches high that I can be eating.
Wow.
I didn't have to plant them. I planted them 9 years ago. I like that.
And they're coming up. So let's go back to the notion of rented land and permanent culture. Not very feasible, is it?
Well, you know, you can make it work in some ways, but it's very unsatisfying to me. And
tell us why it's unsatisfying so that people can fix this notion in their mind, the impermanence of permaculture in a rented piece of land.
Well, let's say, for example, that you want to plant some fruit trees, and you know they're going to take probably 3 years until they're even going to make a single fruit for you. It's a shame to plant those and knowing that you're probably not going to be there. And even if you are still there when they start to fruit, you're going to have put all this time into caring for them, establishing them. You will put the money into buying them. And then when you move on, you have to leave them behind. And that's a sad situation. Once you do it 3 or 4 times, it loses the educational value, I think.
Mm-hmm. And that's what you were doing at Wonder Bread Farm. Describe Wonder Bread Farm a little bit.
Sure. Well, it was a site in the country where we, just near our favorite nursery in the whole world, where I had learned most of what I know about plants. It was walking distance down the road from there. And what was neat about it is that the farm owner had a huge collection of rare livestock. So he had things like dwarf donkeys and emus and rheas and pot-bellied pigs and things like that, which made wonderful manure that we could use. And that was excellent. But we're living out in the country. We had about maybe a quarter acre or half an acre garden there, which is nice, and we could do a lot with that. But ultimately, we knew that we weren't going to be there forever, and every year we weren't sure if we were going to be there the following year. So should we plant more strawberries? Should we plant raspberries this year? It's just kind of sad to not really know if you're going to stick around or not.
So with a rented piece of land, you're kind of really limited then to the possibilities that are very short-term, because that's all you have, right?
You are, and the more work you do to improve the soil, you're just going to walk away from that soil, and it's sort of a shame to put in too much time building up a healthy soil when you're going to be leaving at some point. We also built a small greenhouse there, and we knew we were going to have to take that down and move it with us, so that was a disincentive to build a fancier greenhouse. We ended up building a very, very basic greenhouse.
And the other disincentive to permanent culture for a rented piece of property out in the country was the fact that you're two young men and there weren't any women around, right?
It was a major problem. We were more likely to run into a bear than a woman when we went on a walk there. And that was not what we were looking for.
Not that interested in finding a bear then. So you look to the city, and you look not only to the city, but you look to buying or owning a piece of property in the city And that's something we want to pick up when we come back. But right now we're going to get prepared for a short break. And folks, this is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson here. Today we're talking about a garden, but not just a garden. We're talking about building a garden. And we're talking about how in the building of a garden, all kinds of other things happened and can happen. And I guess it really goes to the heart of what permanent culture is. Today, in today's paper and in today's news, we note with some disdain that there are 90 million people out of meaningful work here in the United States. And what on earth are they going to do? Well, here's a possible model. Two young men took a vacant lot in a rundown city and turned it into a little Garden of Eden. And what else did they grow in that garden? Do stay tuned. This is going to be fun.
Get this. You can earn a 5, 6, or 7-figure income by farming a small parcel of land in or near the city. You can be old or young, rich or poor, married or single. You can rent, lease, or own. You can farm small fruits on prairie bench lands, houseplants in coastal valleys, flowers on steep wooded hillsides, vegetables in city green belts, ornamentals in neighborhoods of million-dollar homes. There's only one catch. You must compete with other farmers for the consumer dollars. You can compete with others and win the consumer dollars with the help of MetroFarm, the guide to growing for profit in or near the city. MetroFarm is the Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner that will guide you step by step through the planning and development of your very own income-generating metropolitan farm. Abraham Lincoln said the greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living on a small parcel of land. Get in on the future today. Get a copy of MetroFarm at www.metrofarm.com.
Welcome back. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael S. Olson here with Eric Tonesmeyer. We're talking about building a garden, but much, much more than that. We're talking about building a permanent culture in an impermanent world. Eric, we were talking about how you left Wonder Bread Farm up there in the hills of where? New Hampshire?
That was also Massachusetts.
Massachusetts, yep. And you headed into town for looking for a piece of property that you could actually own, and also looking for a little culture, right? A little bit of civilization.
Absolutely. I like being able to walk to the farmer's market. I like living where I have friends and walking distance, and the rural life was a little isolating for us.
So what did you look for in a place in the city? I mean, you weren't looking for much, I don't think.
We weren't. Well, we didn't have a whole lot of money to work with, so we couldn't look for too much. We were looking for a duplex with a shared backyard, because our ultimate fantasy was that we wanted to be able to continue to sort of grow old with these fruit trees together and with this edible ecosystem together. But we knew that ultimately we wanted to each have our own side of the house and our own suites and our own families. So we were looking for a duplex that had at least some sunlight somewhere, that wasn't completely contaminated, and that had enough land that we would be able to grow some of the things we wanted to grow. We were hoping for at least a fifth of an acre, and we didn't quite find that, so we ended up with a tenth.
And, you know, when people think of a tenth of an acre, they think, well, that's not much land for something that you want to build that's such a permanent culture. I mean, a tenth of an acre, but it is, isn't it?
Well, you know, we've been able to do an awful lot with it. And frankly, it's a lot to keep up with. If you do it really intensively, it can occupy you pretty well. At this point, we have 43 species of edible fruit on that tenth of an acre.
Wow.
And it's only 45 by 90 in the backyards, which is most of the land.
So you found a duplex. The house is kind of out front on the street, and you have a tenth of an acre backyard.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So what did the backyard look like when you started?
Well, it looked kind of like a moonscape. We have we have three different kinds of terrible soil here, and you could really see them in the far back. The original
three different kinds of terrible soil.
Three, Totally. Well, you're an urban farmer, right? You get this.
Yeah.
So in the back we had an acid sandy soil with some lead in it, and that was had crabgrass was the only vegetation, sort of sparse crabgrass. And then we have a compacted clay fill with nothing growing on it. It was completely bare, and it had big chunks of, you know, concrete and rebar and bricks and asphalt and stuff. And then towards the front, there's a different kind of fill, which is more like a sand and gravel fill, like a moonscape kind of fill.
A genuine urban disaster area.
It was really, well, and it was nice because we wanted to do experimental things, and we felt like we couldn't possibly make it any worse. And it gives you a lot of room to experiment in that case. We also had on the north side two huge Norway maples, which is sort of the eucalyptus of the East Coast, I guess. People really don't like it, and they say it poisons everything that grows underneath. But at least they were on the north side, so we were able to get some sunlight under them at some times of the year.
So the next-door neighbor's problems then.
Unfortunately, yeah. Well, they're growing on their side and hanging over the fence.
Oh,
that was really the town. We would have just taken them down.
So how do you start? I mean, you've got an urban moonscape of three terrible kinds of soil in the backyard. What on earth where do you start?
Well, we the first thing we did was clarify our goals, which we actually did even before we selected the house. We knew what we wanted to do. We knew the main thing we wanted was to create this backyard foraging paradise. That is, we didn't want to maximize production of any one crop, like all blueberries or all raspberries. We wanted to be able to go into the backyard, let's say every day for 6 months of the year, and get a double handful of fruit for everybody who lives here, of fresh fruit. And we wanted fresh greens every day of the year. So that was really the main driver of the design. And then we had a list. We wanted a pond. We wanted a tropical garden. We wanted a tool shed and a compost pile and a greenhouse and all these things.
And that's a lot to ask from a little piece of disaster area soil in the backyard of a, you know, in a rundown neighborhood of Holyoke, Massachusetts. You were kind of like, we're going to turn this into an Eden, right?
Everybody thought we were crazy, and we were, and we have actually been able to do all those things, and that part of the reason is we've been able to do things in the shade. We have a lot of good crops that grow in the shade out here, and that's been one of our keys.
Well, so how did you start building? I mean, you clarified your goal. Why is that important? I mean, why should people actually have a goal?
Well, I feel like if you don't, permaculture sort of encourages this design process where first you clarify what you want and then you learn what the land has to offer, so that you can harmonize your goals with the needs of the land. And what our land needed was a lot of love. And what we learned, though, is that we have, you know, we have these three kinds of soil, and then we also have different sun and shade patterns. And with the overlay between those two things, we get areas, for example, that have terrible clay soil, compacted clay soil, plus full shade in the summer. And you know what grows really well in that situation is a tool shed. Right? That grows great in that situation. So we were able to sort of match the things we wanted with the different patches of conditions that we have.
So first thing, you had to clarify your goals, know where you're going so you can actually get there. But then you had to really understand your land. And you would think that with just one tenth of an acre, it would be easy to just sit there and, well, there's this and there's that, and that's all there is, so away we go. But that's not the case. You really did look at the land, didn't you?
We did. We actually spent most of a year doing that. Meanwhile, we also established a nursery here and moved all of our perennials. But we really wanted to get to know the site and its potential so that we could bring out the very best of it and garden every single square inch, which you have to do if you want to grow that much food on this amount of land. You have to bring out the ultimate potential of every single part of the land, which we're far from having done yet, but we're well on the road to.
And so you really looked at the land, you clarified your goal, you looked at your land, came to understand it in a very intimate sort of way. People think, well, it's just a tenth of an acre, but that's a lot of land if you're looking at square inches, I suppose.
It's a lot of square inches, it really is. And the most important learning that we had from that process of analyzing the land was that there's only one tiny spot that has sunlight in both summer and winter, because we have these big trees on the north and we have big buildings to the south. Only one spot has full sun all year round, and that was the, and we knew we wanted a greenhouse. So that was the, where this process of site analysis sort of discovers the design. Okay, well, now from the limitless possibilities, we're starting to nail down, nail things down.
You know where the tool shed's going, and you know where the greenhouse is
going. That's right. And there's going to be a path between those two things, and everything else sort of unpacks itself from there. That's honestly, I feel like constraints like that are really your friend when you're doing design. It makes those limitations help to
design.
I find, yeah, limitless possibilities overwhelming. I like those. So we started then to pull out the seed of the design and then unpack that design. And we really have been very pleased with where all the pathways were laid out and where all the buildings are. Totally pleased. And we've been completely unpleased with where all the perennial plants got put in. All the woody plants we were happy with, but the understory was all, we did that all wrong. We had to resolve all that later, but well, that process really did help us save trouble down the line. By
so essentially, the land kind of designs itself in many respects.
It really does. You get to know it well enough that there becomes just a logic where it's just clear what you have to do. If your goal is to do this and the land's like that, there's only so many options. And I feel like that's a really valuable thing
to
learn for us.
A blessing in disguise. Folks, this is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson here with Eric Tonesmeyer. We're talking about Paradise Lot, his lot in Holyoke, Massachusetts. Took a tenth of an acre of nothing, turned it into something really special. A beautiful, beautiful perennial permaculture garden. When we get back, let's talk about building soil. Do stay tuned. Well, ladies and gentlemen, consider this. Today there are 90 million people here in the United States that no longer have meaningful work. What if they were to follow in the footsteps of Eric Tonesmeyer and Jonathan Bates and go out and take their little vacant lot of nothingness and turn it into a paradise lot, a permaculture paradise? Wow, what, just can think of 90 million people, what they would do to this country. Oh my goodness. But of course, they would first have to clarify their goals. Then they would have to look at their plot of land and come to know it very well. And then they would have to take their soil and do something with it, as did Eric Tonesmeyer, who was stuck with three terrible kinds of soil. What on earth did you do, Eric?
Well, we went and tested our soils over at the university, of course, to learn what's going on in there. And not to our surprise, they were very low in everything you would want and had some things you don't want in them. Our approach generally is on this kind of a scale in permaculture. People will often use a practice called sheet mulching or lasagna gardening, which is sort of a combination of a weed suppressing mulch along with building a compost pile in place. So the first thing we did was water everything real well, and then we put down whatever amendments had been called for by the soil test, like lime and rock phosphate and so on. And then we laid down a weed barrier, which was basically big pieces of cardboard we'd gotten from the appliance store. And that's to kill the crabgrass and the few tiny, weak little weeds that were in there. It wasn't such a big deal. You can do this on top of a lawn as well, but we didn't really have much of a lawn to speak of.
Yeah, but before you go on, what did your neighbors think when they saw you putting cardboard on top of your ground?
Well, you know, a lot of them were leaning over the fence and looking at us, and one guy had been, he was in his early 90s, and he'd lived in that house his whole life, and he'd never seen anything like this, and he was highly skeptical, and but over the years, he came to see that it really worked, and he was quite impressed, and when he passed away, he told his daughter all about it, and I still see her around every now and then, and she's interested in trying it at her place now, so... It does. over time, it really works. It really does. It's been lovely.
So you lay down the cardboard, and then on top of the cardboard, you did what?
Then we do layers of carbon and nitrogen materials, just like making a compost pile, only they're laid out thin, maybe an inch, you know, or so. And in this case, we were using free stuff, so we went with a lot of leaves. People just throw away organic matter at this time in history, you know?
Sure.
So we went and collected tons of bags of leaves and bags of grass clippings, and we got free wood chips to be the top mulch there, and just had a lovely time getting free things, laid it all out, and in the first year we didn't have quite enough nitrogen in there, but in subsequent years we did, we got it right, and
where do you get your nitrogen?
Well, that year our supplemental nitrogen was household golden fertilizer.
Okay.
And in subsequent years we bought in, we got manure from a farm down the road that I was running at the time.
Okay.
So it was easy enough to bring in livestock manure. Which is marvelous material when you can get your hands on it. You can't always do that. And by the end of the year, that material cooks down. If you pile it up 18 inches high, it cooks down to about 6 inches of very nice crumbly chocolate cake. And in some areas, that was enough for us. In the areas with the compacted clay, that really didn't break down that compaction layer at all. And we made some efforts to do so, but we weren't able to get in here with a subsoiling plow. We chose not to spend a year in a compaction breaking cover crop, which might have been a mistake. And eventually, a few years in, we learned about a tool called a meadow creature broad fork, which is a specially strong steel broad fork. And we were able to use that at that point to go right in and break up. You sort of stab it in the ground, hop on top, and wiggle it around, and it did a beautiful job breaking up the remaining compaction in that area, and we've since then had, you know, double the growth on some of those things in that area. That
right,
like they
right.
Were never
just by just
anywhere.
By freeing the soil up and adding
and
organic,
If you go out anywhere in our garden and lift up the mulch underneath there, it's really full of worm castings. And we've done a really nice job of building organic matter. Our mineral nutrients are still not extraordinarily high. We continue to test, you know, with the home testing kit. But things are growing great, and that really is the criteria that I use for success.
So then, you know, you have a soil to work with now, but gosh, you're talking about plants. Now, you're a perennial guy. You're looking for a permanent culture here. So, and you've been working in perennials too. So you have an idea of where you want to go.
Absolutely. We do grow some annuals, and we wanted to have a few beds for annuals, but most of the annuals require full sun. And frankly, you know, you can get annuals anywhere. I was running a farm at the time, and you can get those things at the farmer's market. We really wanted to experiment with perennial vegetables, perennial fruits, any nuts that we could actually get into this small space, and also looking at nitrogen-fixing plants and plants that attract beneficial insects and weed-suppressing ground covers and so on. So we really wanted to explore this whole world. We ended up ordering in lots of seed from Europe and going out into the woods and collecting native stuff that nobody sells in the nursery trade and just having a great time experimenting with lots of things.
Mm-hmm. Now, in your book, Paradise Lot, you make mention of the fact that in some circles, the whole notion of bringing in plants that are not native is a kind of like a sin of some kind.
Yes.
And yet, how are you supposed to eat plants that are native?
Well, and there are some very nice native edible plants, and we grow quite a few of them. And sort of what I'm saying at this point to people in the native plants community is that when you grow and eat as many native plants as I do, you will have the right to criticize the other things that I grow.
Uh-huh.
Because people say that, but they don't realize that when they go to the supermarket, nothing there is native. There's no native food. I think the only California native you can even buy in the store is miner's lettuce.
Right, right.
In a salad mix. For us, we have a few more things. We have wild rice. We have black walnuts sometimes you can buy. Grape jelly is made from one of our native grapes. But really, there's almost nothing out there. So while we're experimenting with those plants and bringing them into cultivation and starting to domesticate them, gosh, we want to eat, too. So we grow hardy kiwis, and we grow Asian pears, and we're sort of both growing the coolest native stuff we can find and almost anything else we can get from anywhere else
in
the world.
Well, you grow 200 kinds of edible plants on 1/10 of an acre?
We do, and, you know, sometimes that's excessive. We have 70 different species of perennial edible greens, for example, and we really only eat maybe 30 of them regularly. But, you know, you never know. You have a bad year, and those ones don't do well, and those other ones are there, and they're growing in dry shade on their own without any care from you. I say let them grow, and if you need them, that's great. And if you end up just feeding them to the chickens and turning them into eggs, that's not a crime either.
Ooh, gotta talk about chickens in the garden. Who brought the chickens?
Sure, well, Jonathan and I were sort of two...
You gotta hold that story. We're gonna have to take a quick break.
Great,
folks,
great.
Folks, this is the Food Chain Radio program. We're building a garden with the Garden Guys of Paradise Lost. Eric Tonesmeyer, Jonathan Bates, took a tenth of an acre in the back of a duplex in Holyoke, Massachusetts, turned it into a permaculture paradise. People come from all over to check it out. Oh my goodness, look what happened to this ugly vacant lot. It's beautiful. Right back. Well, two boys, 1/10 of an acre, and a permaculture paradise now. So we're talking a little bit about bringing in life, like chickens, to this garden. That's a transformative thing too, isn't it, Eric Tonesmeyer?
Absolutely. We, Jonathan and I initially were scared to have chickens because they're explicitly not legal here in our town. But when our, which, you know, is a legitimate concern, I suppose. But when our wives moved in, they said, oh no, we're getting chickens. You guys are silly. So.
Wait a minute. When did the wives like move in?
Well, okay. So that was, we moved here in 2004 and they both moved in 2007. So I can tell people if they plant a permaculture garden within 3 years, they're guaranteed to be married.
So how did the women show up? I mean, two boys in a duplex in Holyoke, all of a sudden the girls are showing up at the front door, huh?
Well, we kind of feel like the birds who line their nest with shiny objects to attract a mate.
Uh-huh.
I think, you know, they both say that it was not, the garden wasn't the deciding factor, certainly, but I think it did make us a little bit, we stood out from the competition in the marketplace.
From the competition, there you go. Amen to that.
And I think somebody who has goals and is trying to do something and make the world a better place is perhaps, you know, a more interesting and attractive. Certainly wasn't our looks or our fashion sense that did the job, so something must have done it.
So they brought chickens. What was it about chickens that the wives lot wanted that was not there before?
They both, well, eggs was certainly one thing, and they, Meg had grown up on a farm. Jonathan's wife, Meg, grew up on a farm and always had chickens, and my wife, Monty Claire, grew up in the city in Guatemala, and had chickens in the backyard, and they just feel like you need them to have a garden, and we couldn't agree more. The real issue was that we were having a lot of problems with weeds coming up in the mulches we were bringing in. Our mulches were creating weeds, and the chickens, just by eating those weeds, just really transformed our weeding issue, and they also really sped up our fertility cycling. When you have a giant pile of just plain leaves, it doesn't make compost very well. But when you run it through chickens first, it does a beautiful job. So they've just been such an important part of our nutrient cycling and our cuisine, really, because when you add eggs to the mushrooms and greens and fruits we already had, you get incredible desserts. You get fried rice. You get scrambled eggs and
you get a great source of protein, right?
Absolutely. It really enables you to eat the occasional meal that's 100% from the garden with nothing from anywhere else at all. And that's a real treat to be able to do.
So the chickens really enhance the whole notion of permaculture in this 1/10 of an acre parcel.
I think they really do. They turn it from a garden into a living ecosystem much more effectively. Absolutely.
So you, here in Holyoke, Massachusetts, in the backyard of this duplex, you really have something going on. This is cooking. How does the community react to this
Well, you know, it's interesting in that what we thought was going to happen is that everybody on our block was going to do what we did. And that has very much not been the case. We have had certainly some neighbors have planted some fruit trees, and we've sent people home with raspberries and blueberry plants to put in. And lots of people love to come over and eat our fruit. We give lots of tours to our neighbors. We even planted a hedge of berries in the front yard just for our neighbors' kids to eat. So that part has been great. But most of our neighbors don't own their land, so they don't. They have that same issue, and they also don't have the right to garden because the landlord is in charge. So we haven't had that impact here like we had hoped, but we have had, maybe 2,000 people or so have come through our garden over the last 9 years from outside of the community and even outside of the country to come and see what we're doing, and that's been real. We didn't plan for that at all.
So this is a really interesting notion, that the importance of home ownership to the stewarding of land. It does make a difference, doesn't it?
It really does. Now, if you were to have a long-term solid lease somewhere, you could do a lot of the same things.
But if your month-to-month rental, then
really,
you can't even afford to mow the lawn.
Yeah, there's no incentive to care for the land on a month-to-month. There's really an incentive just to misuse it. And that's sort of a problem. I think that's a real problem.
And to an expert in perennial plants, it's kind of just, you can't even go there. It's just no place to go.
I'll never go there again.
And so what were the biggest mistakes that you made?
Well, there have been so many of them, and our position about them is we like to patent our mistakes and not let people repeat them, but open source all of our successes so people can try them and make new and more interesting mistakes instead and pass those along. One of the big mistakes was not, if we'd spent an extra year installing good rainwater harvesting systems, putting in a good irrigation system, breaking up compaction, and building more effective fencing, we actually would have gotten fruit faster, I think. Those things cost money and they take time, and you want to plant the trees.
Yeah, you want to get it in right away. So the important thing is preparing. Well, folks, we got one more break here, and then we're going to come back to the conclusion. And the conclusion that I'd like to talk to you, to Eric about, is what else happened to him and Jonathan as a consequence of not running and chasing after a life, but in planting a garden and then letting the life come to them. This is the Food Chain Radio program. Michael Olson, your host for the hour, with Eric Tonesmeyer, the author of Paradise Lot, Two Plant Geeks, One Tenth of an Acre, and The Making of an Edible Garden Oasis in the City. Do stay tuned, right back.
Get this. You can earn a 5, 6, or 7-figure income by farming a small parcel of land in or near the city. You can be old or young, rich or poor, married or single. You can rent, lease, or own. You can farm small fruits on prairie bench lands, houseplants in coastal valleys, flowers on steep wooded hillsides, vegetables in city green belts, ornamentals in neighborhoods of million-dollar homes. There's only one catch. You must compete with other farmers for the consumer dollars. You can compete with others and win the consumer dollars with the help of MetroFarm, the guide to growing for profit in or near the city. MetroFarm is the Ben Franklin Book of the Year award winner that will guide you step by step through the planning and development of your very own income-generating metropolitan farm. Abraham Lincoln said the greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living on a small parcel of land. Get in on the future today. Get a copy of MetroFarm at www.metrofarm.com.
Well, the boys, they being Eric Tonesmeyer and Jonathan Bates, took a barren lot in a rundown neighborhood of Rust Belt City in a garden and turned it into a Garden of Eden. I mean, including, it had also wives, it had children, it had a business, and it even turned into a book. You know, their work kind of leads me to ask, what would happen if 90 million of us here in the United States who are out of work, out of direction, don't know where to go, would turn to a project like this garden, this paradise lot, and turn their vacant lot into a permanent culture of Eaton, as did the boys. What would happen to our country? I think it would turn into this wonderful place to live. There are so many things to overcome in that regard, of course. It'd be hard, it's hard to do in a situation where you just rent and don't own, but there are ways. What do you think, Eric? You instead of running around and chasing a life, you planted a garden and it came to you.
You know, it's funny because we really did not intend for that to happen at all. We would have designed the garden differently, actually, to have more groups here and so on. When we made the budget, we included expenses, but we didn't include revenue from the garden. And really within 5 years of planting the garden, we were both able to quit our day jobs and do this sort of stuff full time.
So you're actually making money?
We are, and that's by accident. One could certainly do it better on purpose. Jonathan left his job about 3 years ago to do the nursery full-time. Basically, that nursery started because we had too many weeds in our garden, our own plants. We planted these rare things, these cool perennial plants, food plants, were propagating, and we realized every time we weeded one, we could sell it for $10, which is a great incentive to weed. A really good incentive to weed, and he now, that's his job, is running this nursery. He also does some workshops and consults for people, but he sells a lot of plants, not just our own weeds. He has to actually propagate some now, too. But that's been great, and I was able to finally, I was running an urban farm, so that's not exactly out of what I want to do. But really, permaculture is my dream, and I'm particularly interested in that, and I was finally able to leave and just teach and write and do some consulting in there as well. And
so,
we wrote this book together, which I think is going to sell way better than any of my other books because it's a story instead of a how-to book.
And it's a story. But it's also all the other things that came to you as a consequence of having something that was beautiful and real and filled with good food. The wives came, the children came, the business came, the book came, and it all came because you had this one, what do you call it, a shiny things in the bird's nest?
Yep.
So, we're talking to 90 million people out there that today that don't have a job. What would you tell them to do? Where would you tell them to start?
Well, I would try and find a piece of land that you can get some good tenure on, whether you own it or have a good, solid, steady, long-term lease. Look at the waste materials that are available for free in your neighborhood that you can turn into soil or food for livestock. And get started growing some stuff. And if you do it on purpose thinking you're going to make money, you'll do much better than Jonathan and I did, who stumbled into it by accident.
Eric Tonesmeyer, Paradise Lot, Two Plant Geeks, One-Tenth of an Acre, The Making of an Edible Garden Oasis in the City. Thank you so much for joining us. Thank you all out there for tuning in. And remember, cheap food isn't.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.